By the time Daniel learns that he is a Jew, his prejudices have given way to appreciation and understanding. The reader's misconceptions are, of course, expected to follow suit.
The Tikva Fund presents The Character and Education of Daniel Deronda, the fifth episode of an eight-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
Daniel Deronda is the prism through which the main themes of this book are articulated. He is this person who was brought up as an Englishman, and he says, "I am an Englishman." I think that this is something that we should take seriously, that in some sense he never stops being an Englishman, but he is the figure who slowly begins to have sympathy for the Jews, and then to take an interest in the Jews, and then slowly to wonder about who is he actually. And then he meets with Mordechai, who seems to want something of him, who sees some potential in him. Now, until that time, people have been asking Daniel, and he's been asking himself, what am I going to be in life? What am I going to do? Everybody thinks that he has great potential, but nobody understands what particularly he's going to do with that potential. And at a certain point, he finds someone who says, you are what I've been looking for. You are the person who is going to carry out my mission. And this, in a way, becomes the first call that he has had, the first demand that has been made on him to be something that somebody else sees quite clearly. And he is susceptible to that. And the whole rest of the novel really shows his response to Mordechai's insistence that you are the person I've been looking for. So today we are going to talk about Daniel Deronda, the person of Daniel Deronda, and the Yiddish translation of the novel begins with chapter 17, with Daniel rowing on the Thames on a fine summer evening. So reduced to this simple plot, the Englishman rescues the Jewish damsel in distress, creating the complication of his responsibility for her welfare that is resolved with the discovery of her brother and his own Jewish ancestry. And you can see how the book would then end. The advantage of this thin, reductive treatment is that we can see how satisfactorily this Jewish story could have stood on its own, and how well it would have suited the requirement of a good melodramatic novel. And imagining that abridged version, I think, makes us appreciate all the more the author's far greater feat in developing Daniel's simultaneous and different kind of rescue of both Mira Lapidoth and Gwendolyn Harleth. In two very different ways, Daniel Deronda rescues two very different women, one a Jewess, the other an Englishwoman, and he emerges as the mediator between their intersecting worlds. So at a critical point here in this novel, if you recall, Daniel says, "I am an Englishman," a declaration that doesn't lose its importance when we learn that he was born a Jew. Since the novel expected to challenge British prejudice against the Jews, it did brilliantly, it did well, to introduce its hero as an unusual but thoroughgoing Englishman in an upstanding, high-born British family. And only after Daniel has won the affection and admiration of some of the main characters and demonstrated some of his fine qualities, only then does he learn that he is a Jew. And by that time, the readers who have come to trust him may find it hard to reconstruct their anti-Jewish prejudice. There is in English literature and in English culture such a strain of anti-Jewish prejudice, the identification of Jews with everything evil and rotten. And what she felt about that was not only that it was stupid, that it was not true, but she felt that it was very harmful to the British, that essentially you could not really be a civilized people and carry such prejudices against people about whom you knew nothing, really. You just knew their stereotypes. And she became a student of Judaism. She read works of Jewish philosophy. She knew much more about Judaism and began to learn more and more and more about it. And so what to do about it? Well, Daniel Deronda does something quite splendid. It introduces you to an Englishman. When you first meet him, he's a very handsome and very winsome young man when you begin to see how he functions in the book. Very elegant, well-bred, kind. You see him rescuing a woman. You see him critical of someone who's gambling, but when this young woman loses something precious to herself, he redeems this and gives it back to her anonymously so that she shouldn't even know who her benefactor is. He's a wonderful person. You begin to know him. You begin to appreciate him. And then, as the book develops and develops, he finds out that he is a Jew. Then he finds out that he wants to be a Jew, that he's happy to be a Jew. Well, by the time you come to the point in the novel that he actually finds out that he's a Jew, too late. You've already gotten to trust him. You've already come to know him. You've already come to appreciate him a little bit. So through the appeal to the emotions, through the appeal of empathy for this character, you begin to throw aside your earlier prejudice. Your earlier prejudice has to give way in a really meaningful way to the idea that, oh, really? This man is a Jew? Well, maybe I've been mistaken about what I thought about the Jews all along. He is far removed from the real-life Rothschilds on the one hand and from the fictional Shylock on the other, but he does perhaps have a little bit in him of Benjamin Disraeli's diplomatic skills. Now, if Gwendolyn's story traces her development from a naive and self-satisfied girl into a wiser and more generous, if also sadder, young woman, Deronda's character seems fully formed from the start. His part of the book is not a Bildungsroman, not an account of his maturation, I think, but more the modern fable of a banished prince who is trying to find his way back to the palace and to establish the cause of his exile. He is less in search of self-knowledge than of information about where he comes from and what is required of him. The British historian whom I've mentioned before, Gertrude Himmelfarb, has written an illuminating study called The Jewish Odyssey of George Eliot that is both biography and intellectual history of the author. And in this book, Himmelfarb traces how Mary Ann, or Marianne Evans, daughter of a low church Anglican, was given a rigorous evangelical education that familiarized her with the Hebrew Bible and with other ancient aspects of Jewish religion. Ms. Evans developed an interest in the Jews at the same time that she drew away from Christianity. And with greater exposure to European philosophy, she became aware of both its anti-Jewish and philo-Semitic tendencies. She studied Judaism and the Jews with a thoroughness and sympathy that puts many Jewish scholars to shame. This novel seems to transpose part of her emotional development as she develops emotionally, that is to say, the author. She seems to transpose part of that into the character of Gwendolyn and her intellectual Jewish odyssey into the living drama of Deronda's evolution. The character of Daniel Deronda is like George Eliot herself in the sense that he begins slowly to discover the Jews, to learn about them in the same way that she, as an outsider, began to learn something about them. So her character is an outsider to the Jews, as she is an outsider to the Jews. He learns about them at presumably the same pace that she might have learned about them. His curiosity is both positive, oh, let me see what this is about, and then a little bit perhaps standoffish when he has to go to a Jewish pawnbroker and he goes into that pawn shop for the first time and sees the Jews acting in a certain way. Well, the character is not exactly, he's not terribly impressed. He's not he's not biased against them or deeply prejudiced against them. He's open to them, but he doesn't like them very much. Slowly, he comes to know that family better, and then he begins to see how wonderful a family life they have. He begins to appreciate them, even if they're coarse, even if they're not as refined as he is. He begins to appreciate them. I think in all those stages, she may be following some of her own evolution in relation to this question and to this people. By the time Daniel learns that he is a Jew, his prejudices have given way to appreciation and understanding. The reader's misconceptions are, of course, expected to follow suit. So, what are some of the qualities that make Daniel so valuable to others in the novel and so valuable to the author of the novel? Why this figure of Daniel Deronda? So, at an age when the Jewish boy is confirmed in his identity at bar mitzvah age, Daniel is launched instead into a search for identity that is complicated for him by the range of choices available to him. The ambiguity of his birth is his passport to freedom, since he has all the advantages of an aristocratic upbringing without being condemned to live as Sir Hugo's heir. If you think of it that way, it's not that he has been disenfranchised or disinherited. In a sense, because he is not the natural son and heir, he has the freedom not to be that, to be whatever he wants to be. He can study wherever and whatever he likes, that is made clear, which includes a continental education. He can choose any profession he likes, unlike poor Rex Gascoigne, who has to study law, or Gwendolyn, who had she not married, would have had to become a governess. What others regard as a curse, like the term illegitimate, becomes for him a dawning spiritual opportunity. This is the freedom his mother would have wished for herself, and she considers herself blameless for having bestowed this freedom on him. But here is a strange reversal that we see. Daniel's mother felt trapped in her prescribed identity that was forced on her by her father like an affliction and that prevented her from enjoying the life she wanted on the stage. She thought of freedom as something to be gained by refusing to become the Jew that she was commanded to be. Her real life began, as she experienced it, when she contrived to escape her fate as a Jew. And the first Jewish book that Daniel picks up when he goes into the Jewish neighborhood is, not surprisingly, the autobiography of Solomon Maimon that tells a similar story of a boy who escapes the stifling Jewishness of his home to experience the freedoms of individual selfhood. Daniel is in the opposite situation of feeling no enveloping demand on him, of being called to no duty, of feeling himself part of no family tradition. Those are not the portraits of his ancestors on the walls of his home. He bears them no physical resemblance. At a certain point, he broods about the way he had been brought up, quote, which had laid no special demands on him and given him no fixed relationship except one of a doubtful kind. But he did not attempt to hide from himself that he had fallen into a meditative numbness and was gliding farther and farther from that life of practically energetic sentiment which he would have proclaimed if he had been inclined to proclaim anything, which he would have proclaimed to be the best of all life and for himself the only life worth living. So here is someone who is made for a call. And what he experiences is instead the perfect freedom to do anything he wants, but with no call at all, nothing really demanding anything of him. So he blames his upbringing in part for this meditative numbness. But if he wants a life of engaged practical work for himself, he is going to find its purpose himself, or else he won't have it. So following this line of thinking, he becomes aware of a new possibility. If he is less than a complete Englishman, he may also be more than only an Englishman. As opposed to those trying to escape or transcend their identity, the identity into which they are born, he does not think that the claims on him are strong enough. Where are they? Where are those claims on him? So Mira's national identity is inbred. She never was, nor ever could be, anything else but a Jew. Daniel discovers his Jewishness only by setting out to find it. He pursues his identity through an intellectual quest and by expanding his sympathies through investigation and learning, through experience. One could say that he becomes a potential convert to Judaism before he learns that he is a Jew from birth. We learn from his experience, then, something very important, that the concept of national allegiance does not derive exclusively from a traditionally rooted upbringing, not entirely through race, though race matters. It can also come from, and should be intensified by, self-education. There may be something of the Jew, in fact, in every Englishman, if you begin with the Jewish origins of Christianity. And though nationalism means allegiance to one people, Daniel exemplifies what it can mean to become something like a dual citizen, both English and Jewish. Whereas the mystery of the plot hinges on finding Daniel's biological parent, and whereas the impetus for the search comes in different ways from meeting the Jews, Mira, and then Mordechai, Daniel's pursuit of Jewishness and Jewish experience is of the kind that anyone might undertake. And it discloses that part of a national identity that can be acquired. So although the book puts so much emphasis on what is innate, this transition of his, this learning of his, this acquiring of Judaism as he is, step by step, it really does show you the aspects, how deep are, how meaningful are the aspects of a national identity that can, if necessary, be acquired. So Daniel learned first to be an Englishman, and then he learns to be a Jew. Joining the Jewish nation finally gives him the purpose that he has been seeking. Now, Daniel has admirable qualities, especially when compared to some of the others in the book. These are qualities that one comes to associate retroactively with his Jewishness. His moral scruples are the first thing that we learn about him. His revulsion against gambling does not preclude compassion for the gambler, so that despite his disapproval, he generously and anonymously returns to Gwendolyn the necklace that she was forced to pawn. When Gwendolyn later asks him whether he objected to her gambling because she was a woman, he says he regretted it more because she was a woman. But then he explains his objection as follows. Gambling is a besotted kind of taste, likely to turn into a disease. And besides, there is something revolting to me in raking a heap of money together and internally chuckling over it when others are feeling the loss of it. I should even call it base if it were more than an exceptional lapse. There are enough inevitable turns of fortune which force us to see that our gain is another's loss. That is one of the ugly aspects of life. One would like to reduce it as much as one could, not get amusement out of exaggerating it. So he admits that people cannot always correct inequality. And he's not speaking here as a Marxist who sets out to do that. but they should therefore avoid causing it when they can. Deronda's not a moralist according to any prescribed code or system of thought, but through apparently natural instinct, his ambiguous situation has alerted him to the vulnerability of other people. Short of preaching an egalitarian political message, he regrets, as he calls it, the ugly reality that a free society is inevitably going to be inequitable, and that one person's gain is sometimes another's loss. So the bastard son often turns out to be a bastard, a moral bastard. You have to think of just the resentful Edmund of King Lear, right? But Daniel, who resents his uncertain status, becomes more considerate of others as a result. And what do we know? The same applies to Jews, a minority that serves at the political pleasure of host nations and always has to take others into consideration. In other words, what becomes perhaps a moral quality in Jews, that you have to take others into consideration, and that is a teaching of Judaism, is also something in the Jewish way of life. If you are living as a minority in the midst of other people, and economically the only way you can make your living is by providing something useful to the society around you, and if politically the only way of making yourself acceptable is to prove yourself acceptable to the people who are going to protect you, if that is the way you are situated as a people, it will bring out this quality in you of having to understand others, having to know what satisfies them, having to know what makes them happy and makes them want to like you rather than the opposite. So this is what develops in Daniel. So Daniel is occasionally referred to as a romantic, which implies that the heart rules the head. Yet the moral check in his first impression of Gwendolyn alerts us to an equally powerful conservative streak in his nature. We get to see this particularly in contrast with another young man who had fallen in love with Gwendolyn, her cousin Rex. The book tells us that, quote, to a youthful lover like Rex, it seemed that the fundamental identity of the good, the true, and the beautiful, right? The fundamental identity of those things is already extant and manifest in the object of his love, right? Which is precisely the fairy tale amalgam that Daniel is not prepared to grant. And a year later, Rex is still as much infatuated with his beautiful cousin as when she first brushed him off. Similarly, Daniel's good friend Hans Meyrick, sees no obstacle to his passion for Mira in the fact that she takes her Jewishness seriously, whereas Daniel immediately sees that Mira's intense Jewish loyalty is going to be an impediment to a romantic union with anyone who is not a Jew. So his attraction to both women is tempered by psychological insight that makes him aware of how they function apart from him and what sort of relationship with them would be possible. At best, I think, one could call Daniel a romantic conservative, unless you prefer to call him a conservative romantic. But one way or the other, these two qualities are bound in him and do not work against one another. Of course, certain aspects of Daniel's nature are related to his longing for his missing mother. Now, Mira's mother guides her even when she is no longer with her, right? Daniel is in search of the same quality of mother love, of an attachment deeper than anything else can provide. Deronda's first two actions in the book both involve the rescue of women. Both are performed with the greatest delicacy and tact. The rescue of Mira, we note, is strikingly different from the subsequent one of Gwendolyn's necklace. Subsequent chronologically, though it comes first in the book, in that he is literally in harmony with this girl. We note Daniel has been singing to himself as he rose, and in their first exchange, it turns out that Mira knows this song, the gondolier song in Rossini's opera, Otello. And the words that she is singing, or that she hears him, the melody singing, is, there is no greater sorrow than to recall in misery the time when we were happy. Now, they're not singing a duet quite, but the music and the words are equally familiar to them both. She says that for her, the dolore and the miseria, the misery, have lasted longer than the happier things. At the point of helping her into the boat, he is shaken by the thought, perhaps my mother was like this woman. This is the first thought he has about her. Perhaps my mother was like this woman. He is always searching for that unknown mother whom he imagines as someone in need of him. He is in need of her, but he always imagines her as being in need of him. This interweaving of the rescue, the music, and the image of his desperate mother all happen before he learns that Mira is Jewish. Having just witnessed and shared this sorrow of this woman whom he connects with the image of his mother, one can then better understand Daniel's disappointment, his critical reaction, when he sees Gwendolyn gambling in Germany. So Daniel's first exposure to Mira is then deepened by his association with her gentleness and with her need of protection. In caring for her and about her, he becomes sensitive to how others treat the Jews. To be caring, however, and even protective, is not yet to consider someone your equal, much less to want to become like them. So the thorniest part of Daniel's evolving attitude towards the Jews occurs when he is trying to find Mira's brother among the Jews who are already settled in London. The shop and the family of Ezra Cohn gives us the kind of mixed picture that we find in several other George Eliot novels, the picture of a family that is warm and wholesome despite its coarseness. Right? Here, the normalcy of family relations offsets the strangeness of Jewish customs. That little Jacob Cohn, like any five-year-old boy, is fascinated by a penknife makes it less exotic that the family's boarder is instructing him in Hebrew, and that the family enjoys sharing their Sabbath best with their Gentile visitor mitigates the father's preoccupation with money. One can almost feel the author trying not to idealize the Jewish family in the process of rehabilitating its image. And by the way, the Jewish family image is always the bourgeois family image. And it's that also, in a sense, that is being rehabilitated here. It's a very strange combination that in some people's minds becomes inseparable, right? So the ease with which Daniel gets to know them and feels comfortable among them reflects as well on them as it does on him. He is simultaneously the conduit through which we approach Jewish reality and an example of how the Jewish sensibility differs from British codes. Just compare what the Jewish family feels like and what the Malinger family feels like when we see it in its own enclave, right? You can just see the qualities of warmth, the qualities of interaction that are present in one situation and by contrast, really absent in the other. Now, one quality that strikes me most forcibly about Deronda is sounded in that marvelous phrase right at the beginning in the opening paragraph, a longing in which the whole being consents. The young man knows that he is capable of wholehearted devotion without mental or moral reservation, perhaps because he missed out on this kind of unqualified devotion that we associate with mother love. He keeps the ideal of it alive. In fact, the most poignant expression of this longing comes, not surprisingly, when he confronts the person who fractured his life, when he confronts his mother, the Princess Leonora Halm-Eberstein. He dearly wants to reduce her suffering. And at this point, since he's unable to ease her pain, he tries to do what he assumes must bring her comfort. He wants her to give up the resentments, the fight against her father and against Judaism, and to accept at least his happiness in learning that he is a Jew. So he pleads, and these are his words, "Can you not bring your whole soul to consent to this?" Of course, she cannot, whereas he cannot settle for anything less. the repetition here of that opening phrase makes us think harder about just what it signifies. And I hear in it what Jews hear in the emphasis of the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your might, which is addressed in a religious context to the Almighty, but which also becomes a Jewish way of being. The Jew longs for the land of Israel with all his heart and soul, and prays to it, and prays for being returned to it. He consents to the covenant with all his might. Naseh v'nishma. George Eliot's hero is an unencumbered young man who finds completion in loyalty to a Jewish woman and in the undeviating loyalties of the Jewish people. So this is something extremely attractive to him, and clearly an attractive quality in this novel. I think that in the figure of Daniel Deronda, George Eliot was specifically targeting a contrasting image of the Jew that was by then very popular in Germany and becoming popular elsewhere, most popularized by Heinrich Heine, who was considered to be one of the greatest poets that Germany ever produced and was very well known in England and elsewhere. So Heine describes himself as a torn man, a torn soul, and he made a virtue of it, writing, "Whoever claims that his heart is still whole merely acknowledges that he has a prosaic heart," right? With the loss of religious conviction and the substitution of political freedom for autocratic tradition, the world, he says, has been ripped in two, and the divided being personifies the modern spirit. The Jew, then, for Heine, is that modern spirit. And that's what he is not alone in trying to sell that image, right? The Jew is modern because he is torn, living in one place, longing for another, raised in one religious tradition and acculturating to another without wholly giving up the first. So George Eliot knew her Heine, and chapter 34 takes as its epigraph the quotation from Heine's famous poem about the divided Jew, Princess Sabbath, it is called, in which the Jew lives all week long like a dog, grabbing scraps from other people's tables. A very unpleasant image of the Jew, but on the Sabbath assumes his original princely form. But every Friday night at dusk, suddenly the spell on him is lifted and the dog becomes human once again. So this epigraph is used to introduce the scene in which Deronda experiences Sabbath at the pawnbroker's home, when, for the moment, Deronda thought that this pawnbroker, proud of his vocation, was not utterly prosaic. See, so the same split, really, of what is poetic, what is prosaic, what is whole and what is broken. From Heine's description of the fatally diminished Jew, Eliot plucks out the element of redemption, what happens on the Sabbath. German Jews developed a style of wit which was known as the Judenwitz, the Jewish wit, which specialized in self-mockery as the best means of anticipating and deflecting the taunts of one's detractors. Though Daniel Deronda is the antithesis of the compulsively ironic Jew. He's the antithesis of all that we boast of when we say, oh, look at this self-deprecatory Jewish humor, and so on. You notice Daniel Deronda's not very funny. Right? He is aiming for something else, a wholeness, which is not what humor aims at. His goal is contentment and the integration of things. And Eliot was trying to offset the Byronic influence in England and Heine's influence on the continent. So by the end of the novel, Daniel will have found his purpose in leading the Jews. But in the process, he also becomes very important to those around him because of what is missing in them. Sir Hugo is decent and tolerant, but like the Meyricks, he takes for granted that Jewishness is something to be overcome. He is certain, he is confident, that he's done his ward a favor by concealing his Jewish birth, and who can blame him if he has been fulfilling the wishes of the Jewish mother who ought to have known what was best for her son? Growing up in this Malinger home, Daniel was raised on negative stereotypes, but as he learns more about the Jews, he begins to lessen Jewish prejudice by example, and then you see that he really does change Sir Hugo Malinger's relation to the stranger in your midst. Not that you have to take him and make him into the perfect Englishman, but you have to understand that he may want to be the perfect something else that he is. And the Reverend Gascon, who gives out solid advice and kindly spirit, is another good man, but his ministry lacks any trace of reverence or awe, much less religious devotion. Neither marriage nor death is accompanied for the Christians in this book by meaningful religious rites, and Christmas, as we've noted, is stripped of any religious connotation. Gwendolyn, as a young wife, moves in the author's summary, listen to this sentence, from church at one end of the week to opera at the other. Daniel, on the other hand, has such heightened sensitivity that the narrator often has to account for it. So Sir Hugo takes a certain pride in Daniel Deronda's differing from him, which the book describes thus as a deeper state of feeling. This state of feeling was kept up by the mental balance in Deronda, who was moved by an affectionateness such as we are apt to call feminine, disposing him to yield in ordinary details, while he had a certain inflexibility of judgment and independence of opinion held to be rightfully masculine. So if we said romantic conservative, then here we see also these two qualities. Feminine, that is to say that quality which in British terms seems feminine, right? To Hugo Malinger it seems feminine, and that is that quality that is moved by an affectionateness and wanting to please, and on the other hand, this independence of opinion, being able to be judgmental, right? Which is, according to this scheme of things, rightfully masculine. So this balance between empathy and judgment might once have defined the character of the ideal priest. So his passion will hopefully restore to the English this spiritual need for a national identity and national identification, which is made up of that same balance. And his strongest influence is, of course, on Gwendolyn. Following the scene with her husband in which Grandcourt is imagined as the potential vicious colonizer, the narrator tells us that Gwendolyn did not part with her recovered faith in the goodness of Deronda. Rather, she kept it. She kept her faith in him with an anxious tenacity, and this is from the book, as a Protestant of old kept his Bible hidden, or a Catholic his crucifix, according to the side favored by the civil arm. That's Deronda. What does this mean, right? She holds on to his goodness and to the idea that he is good and that one can be good the way a Protestant kept his Bible hidden and a Catholic his crucifix. That is to say, it's something that you couldn't reveal, but you kept it because that was your religious consciousness. So this is one of several explicit comparisons of Deronda to the religious support that a Christian might once have found in his own religion, but does not any longer. So let's bluntly say that I think what she wants, she considers him her savior, and that the book considers the spiritual capacity of Jewish life, including the Jewish quality of nationhood, as the necessary corrective for the drying out of Christian faith in Britain. Gwendolyn's reliance on Deronda, Sir Hugo's reliance on Deronda, the Meyricks' admiration and gratitude for Deronda's assistance to Hans, their brother and son, the steady contrast between Deronda and Grandcourt, rescue in place of domination, exquisite courtesy in place of exquisite sadism, all this underscores the importance of Daniel and the importance of this character to English society, independently of whatever help he is eventually going to bring to the Jews. Daniel's evolving discovery of the Jews becomes more than a literary means of overcoming prejudice and more than an avenue to increased understanding. His turning out to be a Jew challenges the English to appreciate what a necessary resource they have among them in the example of Judaism that can come through the presence in their midst of the Jews. So we're still left with the question of how the banished Jew can find his way home to the Jewish people. It's obviously easier to learn the history of the Jews. I didn't say it was easy, but it is easier. And to study Jewish philosophy than it is to feel at home in a synagogue or at a Sabbath table and to make the transition from the third person, we're talking about them, to the first person plural, we're talking about we, when you talk about the Jews. And to what shall Deronda adhere? What can capture his imagination and engage him fully enough to make him want to take on the fate of the Jew? What's the attraction of Judaism that might make the contemporary Englishman happy to have been born a Jew and eager to belong to this people? So the answers are, of course, to be found in the encounter with Mordechai. That will be our next subject. And he attracts Deronda and becomes his teacher. Mordechai is in some ways the most shadowy and mysterious character in this book. And for some readers, he is the most problematic element in the plot. But his impact on Deronda has as much to do with the needs of the student as with the personality of the teacher. And I find it psychologically highly persuasive that the attraction of Mordechai lies not in what he offers Deronda, but in how much he asks of him. Deronda looks for his mother not to be rescued by her, but because he thinks her in need of rescue. He wants to lead. When his teacher thinks he may have the makings of a scholar or a thinker, he says, "I don't want to be a Leibniz. I would rather be a great leader like Pericles or Washington." And to demonstrate the fanaticism of her father, the Princess Helm Eberstein tells Daniel that this is what his grandfather, her father, used to say. She has no use, she says. "Every Jew should rear his family as if he hoped that a deliverer might spring from it." Every Jew should raise his family as if he believed that the Messiah will spring from it. That's the deliverer, is the Messiah. She takes this as fanaticism. Daniel's mother cannot bear this crazy search for a redeemer, whereas Daniel asks eagerly, "Were those my grandfather's words?" That's just the charge that he was hoping to hear. So Mordechai is looking for someone to carry on his unfinished work, and he's been looking all the harder because he is running out of time. Let's keep that in mind. Mordechai is running out of time. Whatever he is in the novel, he's not going to be there much longer, right? The grandfather insists that every Jew should rear his family as if he hoped that a Messiah might spring from it, which is like saying that you shall be unto me a nation of priests. So I would only end by saying this, that if we doubt the realistic possibility behind Daniel's apprenticeship to Mordechai, we have only to think of modern leaders as different as Zev Jabotinsky and Menachem Schneerson, both of whom attracted young followers by how much they demanded of them in changing the Jewish people. Nothing in the complacency of British society, as George Eliot describes it in this novel, calls for the same level of devotion and the same ability for heroism. So there's Daniel. Thank you. Yes. Daniel's teacher thinks that he can become a great scholar, and his guardian, Hugo Malinger, thinks that he can go into government or do something else. And so people do see that Daniel has something in him, but when Daniel is told by his teacher that he can become a philosopher or a scholar, he says, "I don't want to be Leibniz. I want to be like Washington. I want to be a leader." So he feels that he wants to take a role in society which is meaningful. Now, if you were taking a role in British society which is meaningful, then I would say that, yes, you could go into government. If you wanted to be a leader of the British people, you would become a leader in government. However, once Daniel begins to recognize the potential of the Jew and to see that what Mordechai wants of him is to be a leader of the Jews, then the question is, how are you going to become a leader of the Jews if they do not have a polity? What does it mean to be a leader of the Jews if there is no Jewish government? And so interestingly, the question seems to be posed almost inside out. There is no leader job that he could apply for. The only way he can become a leader is to lead the Jews into the context within which he could be a leader. That is to say, you first have to reclaim Jewish nationhood. You first have to reclaim Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel before you can become that kind of a leader. What would be perfectly natural within a British context is not possible yet within a Jewish context until you first create the nationality, until you first create the form of nationhood that would that would allow you to be this kind of leader.
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.